But then I started having people coming up to me over the course of EGX and saying, like, you know, how much money are you looking for to finish this project? And in the back of my mind, I suddenly thought, oh, the reason why they're offering funding is because they think that they can make money off the back of this. So it did kind of shift that gear in my own head as to like, oh, okay, if they think they can make this into a, you know, a business prospect, then that is 100% the next step for me. I should do that myself.
This is Inside Indie Games. Join us behind the scenes to see what it takes to create a great indie company and to craft the games that people long to play. We've talked a lot so far this season about whether or not to specialise in one particular area of making games. Well, on this episode, we're speaking to John Evelyn. He's the creator of an entirely hand-drawn first-person adventure game called Collage Atlas. And he wears many, if not all, of the hats in the project, as you'll find out in a minute. John's one-man band approach is fairly uncommon these days. Perhaps it can be traced back to one of his tutors at university, who essentially advised him to become a jack of all trades. He was studying a media course at the time and later went on to work on a number of marketing film campaigns, doing things like graphic design, coding and digital design. But a serious illness made John reevaluate his priorities and he decided to throw himself into his main passion of making games the moment he was discharged from hospital. I was still curious to find out why he thought his tutor gave him that advice though. Why didn't he recommend that John specialise and try to become a master of one particular area?
So what it was at the time, like I was in a band and he knew I was in a band. He knew I was writing music and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he knew I was doing graphic design around these things as well. And he knew that I was doing some programming on the side, like freelance kind of stuff.
Sure.
So I think what he was aware of is that I wasn't really capable of leaving any one of them well alone. You know, mm-hmm. For some people they really do dabble, but in all honesty, if they were told like tomorrow you're never going to write another line of code, they'd be like, oh, okay, fine. You know, yes, I was passable, but even though I didn't really excel at any of these things, like I had a huge passion for all of them. And so for me, the pursue all of them thing wasn't so much advice as like more a kind of, well, it sounds like you're going to try and do that anyway. So like, carry on. So yes. Like, around the same time, one of my best friends, used to say to me, look, you know, you're trying to do too many things at once. And if you're really going to excel, you're going to have to choose, like, are you going to do music? Are you going to do art? You know, which of these things?
Yeah.
But for me, I think to really do your best at something, to really push yourself, you have to thoroughly enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah.
And after really slogging away at one aspect, say the art, for a while, I'd need a break from it. I'd be losing sort of the passion, so I'd divert my attention to something else. So for me, spinning a few plates means that I enjoy spinning each one individually. Yes. I just... Yeah. As I'm kind of winding down on one, I'll move to the other and then I'll come back to the other one again a little bit later. So yeah. For me, it was good advice. For other people, I'd be very keen to see, like, is there an absolute need for them to be involved in all the things? Or is there really, if you're really honest with yourself, is one of the things more a natural fit? Mm-hmm. And if there is a natural fit, then by all means, specialize.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question, actually. I wonder if that's partly what splits the population around, you know, people who excel in a particular role within a larger company between those who want to go and work for an indie company or even start their own thing. It feels like possibly that kind of jack of all trades approach or personality or liking to do lots of different things might suit running a company, for example, certainly a small company more effectively. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually one of the real key skills that you need to work either in a very small company or indeed solo, and it's one that's not talked about an awful lot because it's not particularly glamorous, is you have to basically be, even if you're working on your own, you also have to be a producer. You have to put on the producer hat and sit down with yourself and say, what are the actual tasks? What is absolutely essential? Well, what are reasonable milestones to hit? And I don't mean milestones in the next 3 months. I mean, milestones by lunchtime. Yes. Like, what could we get done today? So you could be good at art, good at audio, good at programming, but there is that last crucial one. Are you good at organizing yourself?
Yeah.
And I'd almost argue that actually you can dial the other skills down a couple of notches, but if you're incredibly organized, that's the thing. That's the thing that means you ship stuff. And that's the thing that means you promote stuff effectively. Mm-hmm. And that could be the difference between really succeeding and not.
Yeah. Is that something you've got to strengthen, do you think? Or is that something you've developed?
Well, as it happens, this last weekend I was best man at my best mate's wedding. So I was very much in that, like, right, we've got to do this at this time, which means that half an hour before I have to do this, means half an hour before I have to do this, half an hour before I have to do this. And that's kind of how my brain works. I kind of pick a point on the horizon and work backwards from there and see, like, how we're going to get there. It's something that I used to have to do a lot working at media agencies. We have very short turnaround projects.
Yeah.
You could be the best graphic artist in the world, but if you miss the deadline, none of your work counts for anything. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Those years working in and around like Soho as it did, like I think really helped hone those skills. I'm still certainly not a superhero at it. And actually, I would love to hire someone who just likes organizing things just to do that, so I can be a bit more chaotic. But I've got a certain degree of skill there, I suppose.
Someone you developed. It sounds like your previous career as well in marketing helped with that, certainly.
Yeah. I think one of the other things it really made me aware of is how to be a really bad boss as well, or how to be a really bad client, I think is more important. So I had the kind of clients that really would move the goalposts at the 11th hour. You'd work literally all night. And then at 9 in the morning, they'd say, oh, actually, that's not quite what we want now. We've changed our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, is pretty hideous. But remembering that and being able to apply those sort of rules to even when you're working on your own, I think are really important. Because you can be, when you're a solo dev, you can be your own worst client by working on something for 2 days that's kind of a little bit ambiguous and you're not totally clear on what the end goal is. And then seeing it and going, oh, actually, I don't really like that, I think those experiences helped in that regard as well.
John told me he'd actually been putting out Flash games in his spare time during his marketing career too.
I used to work crazy hours at a media agency, and then at home I'd be like, I have this idea for a game and I'm going to do that. They were small little things, but they'd go up on sites like, I say, Newgrounds and like Addicting Games, who I don't know if they're still around, and there was like Spill, who were a big network. So I used to put those things out. But what that really hit home then was that I could transfer the lessons of dealing with clients in the office hours into dealing with a client when I'm shipping my own game, even though they were very small games. So it shaved off a certain degree of the anxiety and probably outright fear of then making the full jump into games, because I'd already put games online and people had already said, this is the worst thing I've ever played, and and all that kind of stuff. We'd been there. It helped. Yeah.
You said that you could bring forward lessons from working with clients in your previous career. What do you think you would tell people if they were first starting to work with clients? What were your big lessons?
I think the main thing for me is, I personally struggle with people who have like a kind of a professional personality and like a social personality that are mm-hmm. entirely separate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really understand how people are able to split themselves like that. They walk into the office and they're a certain kind of person. And when they're at home, they're a completely different kind of person.
Yes.
And I think just being honest and transparent is probably the most valuable thing to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And in transparency, I say to kind of extend that a little bit further, I'm someone who even recently, I was just last year working with a freelance graphic designer, and I said to him, please don't ever try and give me like any kind of optimism with timelines, with deadlines. Always give me bad news. Tell me it's actually going to be 2 weeks late. and that's fine. Don't tell me it'll be here in a week and then run late. And I personally like that. I'd much prefer someone say, yeah, like the building's going to definitely burn down. Oh, actually, it turns out it was fine.
Yes.
Rather than downplay things. So I think setting expectations of people accordingly is probably one of the most valuable lessons I learn. And so certainly that means with regards to when I'm making my current game, when people are asking how long it's going to be, which is a frustrating question when you're making games because, well, that's a whole can of worms, you know. But if someone says how long is it is, I'll say it's 2 hours, whereas in my mind I'm thinking it's going to almost certainly be double that. But let's play it safe.
So now John's working exclusively on his game, Collage Atlas. And it seems that the game is working exclusively on him too. I asked him if he was literally delving into everything from the development to the art to the production and beyond.
When I see sort of the horror on other people's faces, I suddenly realise this is madness. But yes, I'm currently doing everything. I write all the code at the moment. I'm writing and recording the soundtrack. Actually, I've been doing that this week. I do, the animation, the integration of the art, do the design or documentation, all that kind of stuff. And also any kind of social things, which takes so long, so I record dev diaries and they take me like 2 days. So yeah, it's a lot. I'm doing a lot.
Yeah. Do you have any plans to change that anytime soon? Or are you happy the way you're working right now?
I think, it has to change really. There's a point at which, for me, because I guess there aren't really absolute kind of universal, truths with how to make games. There are so many different approaches. But for me, we're now coming out of this kind of slightly chaotic, very creatively high energy phase of the project into a let's refine this, let's get this to a really like sound state so that people can just play it, the computer won't burst into flames and they'll have a really good time.
Yes.
So with that transition period into the more formal production, I absolutely am going to be looking to kind of bring on some help so that I can just do a good job basically.
So the unique thing about Collage Atlas is that it's entirely hand drawn, literally with pen and paper. Given that there are obviously much more efficient and faster ways to make a game, I was interested to find out where had this idea originally sprang from.
About, I think it was 2012, I self-published a picture book. Mm-hmm. And I'd only recently started drawing again because I stopped for like about 10 years. And because I'm an idiot, the first thing I decided to do was to draw a picture book. So I did that, and an awful lot of people were saying, I just really want to walk into these, I want to step into these pictures, and that really stuck in the back of my mind. In 2016, I thought maybe I could make another picture book, but instead of it being on pen and paper, it'd be a thing that you do walk through. But it really was going to be as simple as that. It was still going to be a picture book, not at all like a traditional game-like experience. But then as I started to sort of suspend text in the air in 3D spaces and walk around it, I suddenly realized, viewing this from different angles is interesting. Is there something here? Maybe there's a puzzle mechanic here. And then unfortunately the floodgates in my mind opened and it turned from a very linear picture book idea into a branching adventure game. I made a very rough prototype. It's a 3D kind of space you walk within, but the prototype was actually made using a piece of 2D game software and just an awful lot of trigonometry. So it's like faux 3D. It was just scaling every object in the world around you to make it look like 3D. Mm-hmm. A bit like, I guess, old first-person shooters from the beginning of the 90s, but just not as clever. And I made a very small scale little experience. It was like a 10-minute long thing. And I was very fortunate that I managed to get selected for the Left Field Collection at EGX. And that's where they show the slightly more, I guess, esoteric kind of games, would be the nice way of making me sound like I'm not, not a complete weirdo. But there you go. My game was odd enough, I guess, that it got in there.
Yes.
And what it was is I actually... aside from being called massively pretentious, which is part of the course, some people really liked it. It seemed to really resonate. And so it's not that the game kind of suddenly became bigger, like a runaway train kind of thing. There was, like I say, this 10-minute kind of experience that I felt like, yeah, I've explored that idea as much as I'm willing to without knowing that anyone's interested. And actually, there was an interest. So I thought, okay, that's kind of empowered me to go away and really dig into this now. What more can be done with it?
So once the prototype was up and running, what were the next steps on John's agenda?
It was a very kind of playful time in creating, as I say, because I just suddenly realized this is what I need to be doing. So I wasn't really pursuing it with an industry hat on. I really was just like, let's see what I can do with this. Is it fun? And when people said they did like it, like friends and family said, you know, this is really interesting. And I was sharing stuff to Instagram and all that kind of stuff. It was actually that then I thought, well, the Left Field Collection, I visited before, I'd played some amazing things there. And I just thought, man, I would really love my game to be, you know, in there amongst creations that I really admire. So I just gave it a shot. I didn't actually apply to anything else. I didn't apply to any other exhibitions or anything. It wasn't really a phase one, make prototype, phase two, get into as many shows as possible. It was just really the Left Field Collection, to be honest. I just thought that would be, if I was ever going to be anywhere, that's the place I want to be. So,
at this point, John was still doing the odd bit of freelance graphic design work to help support himself. But was it now time to start looking for funding?
Standing in the Left Field Collection was just like, you know, it was great. I loved the other games that were showing there, and some people seemed to really kind of click with what I was doing. But then I started having people coming up to me over the course of EGX and saying, like, you know, how much money are you looking for to finish this project? And in the back of my mind, I suddenly thought, oh, the reason why they're offering funding is because they think that they can make money off the back of this. So if they think they can, then I should think so too, you know. So it did kind of shift that gear in my own head as to like, oh, okay, if they think they can make this into a, you know, business prospect, then that is 100% the next step for me. I should do that myself. Mm-hmm.
And what did you do about that then? What was your next step?
Well, I mean, the UK Games Fund was actually, I think, right at the forefront of my mind. You know, I'd spoken to people like Creative England and that kind of thing, who were really, really lovely, really charming people, and really, you know, really positive. And I'd spoken to publishers, and some people, you know, they wanted to get in very early on the game, but I realized that I needed a bit more space, I guess, creatively, early on, because it was a rough prototype, and I needed to find what the real game was at the heart of this. What was the actual, you know, commercial game at the heart of this slightly janky prototype? So grants were, I think, more appealing initially. Just all I needed was a very small grant just to tide me over for a couple of months to find, yeah, as I say, what is the commercial product here?
And what about the ideas behind what actually went into the game? Did John's one-man band approach extend to this area too?
The way that the prototype kind of came together is I really just married all my personal sort of passions. So the drawing style in the game isn't me trying on a certain style or whatever else. I'm actually not a particularly good illustrator, I would argue, in that my illustrations all look exactly the same. Like, I have this one style. And the soundtrack, the music, again, was not trying to write specifically in a certain style for this game. It's the kind of music I've been recording for, at that point, God, I don't know, like 17 years or something. So similarly, all the ideas I had, they had a similar kind of feel, if that makes sense, so that everything was just a natural fit. I basically just thought, well, and this is not particularly good games design advice, because this is basically the mother and father of feature creep. But I basically thought, well, every idea I've ever had that I thought was kind of interesting, I'll put it into this game. Okay, we're past that now, by the way. We've locked things down, but yeah, early on, that's kind of what it was. I didn't really need to shop it around to people and say, what kind of thing would you like to see in this?
So as John moves beyond creation and on to refinement, I asked him if he was now looking for a publisher to help him get his game out there.
I was very fortunate to have had a UK Game Fund backing for the, we'll call it round two of prototyping, because as I say, there was the very early rough prototype, which was made in Construct. And then last year I started, I rebuilt the whole thing, did all the artwork again, and we made in Unity. And it started to look like a quote unquote actual game, you know? And then I did actually have to do all the kind of businessy bits. I went to an investor summit at EGX last year, and I spoke to publishers and all this kind of stuff, and tried to find, you know, a natural fit. And actually earlier this year, I got speaking to the Indie Fund, which is, I don't know if you're aware of them, but it's a, you know, it's a group of, I don't know, even know how many different developers, some publishers, some people that work in retail spaces. And you basically email them your pitch, essentially, and say, this is what I want. But it's essentially it's private equity, you know, mm-hmm. But it's private equity from people who, you know, they're not just randoms throwing money at games. They really, you know, they understand the demands on a game design project. So they're, you know, the ideal kind of backers. And I was fortunate enough to get investment from them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's brought this into full-time production. And currently I'm speaking to publishers now as well, because I think there's only so much I can do on my own. And I really think, this might sound a bit daft, but I think basically you could write the greatest poem in the world, right? But if it lives in a drawer and nobody reads it, in my mind, it doesn't exist. Yes. I'm really personally not making this for my own amusement. I really need this game to get in front of as many people as possible. So yes, currently talking to publishers.
Yeah.
And we'll finally be unveiling the game as it currently stands at EGX in, oh God, what is it now? Five weeks? Yeah.
John told me that going to exhibitions and getting in front of real life people was factored into his pitch for the Games Fund. I wondered what his best experience was so far, you know, of getting in front of those people who could really help him get the game out to the rest of the world.
So the first round of, you know, the Left Field Collection initially, that was really interesting because, yeah, publishers did just kind of walk up and play a thing and say, how far is this from completion? And also the Investor Summit that I went to last year at EGX was great, because you kind of... you filled out your kind of proposal for the game, and then they had a pool of investors and publishers who would look at all the submissions and decide who they wanted to sit down and have a chat with. So it was a kind of a bit of a speed dating kind of situation, you know. And you sit down for 5 or 10 minutes with each one and run through it. And I think that Investor Summit overall has been probably the most valuable event I went to, even though I didn't end up going with anyone I spoke to that day. Yeah. This huge amount of insight that I got from various publishers there was tremendously valuable. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible to, well, it's certainly possible to self-publish these days, but do you think it's wise to do it entirely on your own?
I at the risk of being a little bit like ambiguous, I don't think there is a universally accepted kind of wise or unwise kind of rule here. Mm-hmm. It's down to the individual. I think you have to have a huge amount of self-awareness. You have to kind of look at yourself as a games designer, as a developer, and say, like, am I honestly capable of doing this? And am I honestly capable of doing a better job of it than someone else would? Or, you know, are the returns, is the amount of profit share I'm going to give away to a publisher really worth what they're going to do for me. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's a real case by case thing. You absolutely can. You absolutely can self-publish. You know, you absolutely can self-promote and everything now. The world is wide open for you, yeah. But it's down to, you know, whether you're really going to make a good hand of it yourself.
Yeah. What do you think are the biggest benefits of taking on a publisher?
Well, I mean, I guess that's going to depend very much on the publisher. I actually spoke to one last year who basically sort of talked themselves out of, or talked me out of working with them on the grounds that they were like, you kind of seem to know what you're doing with your game. And a lot of the services we would offer you are like more or less mentoring and guiding your milestones of your production and that kind of thing. Okay. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. Well, I'd much rather look for someone who's creatively engaged with the project and is going to say to me, we've thought this amazing way of promoting it that you've never thought of before, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know if I answered your question.
No, that was really good, actually. I think that's interesting in that you talked earlier about the fact that possibly that's one of your strengths from your past experience, and that running a company and developing a game does take a lot of management. It takes a lot of organization, which obviously a lot of games developers, whether they're a developer or whether they're, you know, an illustrator, whatever aspect you come from, maybe that's not a skill that you have. So that's something that it's possibly worthwhile working with a publisher on, in that they end up obviously almost a project manager for the game.
They can be, yeah. I mean, in this instance, there was actually, you know, they explicitly saying, like, we would happily basically install a producer, you know, on your project.
Oh, I see. And right. Okay.
Really, just wasn't the need for that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but I can see a lot of companies or projects where that could be really valuable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are some people out there. I've met some really annoyingly talented, very young people. You know, these are people who are good. Like, they're making remarkable things now, and they're 20 years old. So yes. God knows what they're going to be doing in 10 years' time. And some of those people, really, with the fire in them and the creativity in them, they should just be concentrating on making. They should just be entirely immersing themselves in that. Yeah. And by all means, I think if they can find someone else to provide some kind of infrastructure around them, that's by no means a bad thing.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I think that's really good advice. Let's finish up just with, I just wanted to ask a general question about the kind of the type of game that you're making, actually. I feel like, having, especially on the mobile platforms, having looked and been trying to find like new games to play over the last few years, that there's a lot more of the kind of free form, art based, relaxing type games. Like the words beautiful and meditative and stuff like that crop up quite often in descriptions these days, as well as the unique artwork as well, actually. Do you think that's, I see that as a bit of a trend these days. Obviously your game falls into that. Why do you think that is?
I'm not entirely I guess there is a trend currently, but
well,
I
tell
think
me if you think there isn't of, certainly yeah
I think it's maybe indicative of a sea change in games. So when I was a kid and me and my friends thought, wouldn't it be great to make games, we were playing Streets of Rage 2, and to us video games was like either, you know, blowing things up for scores or punching things for scores or driving faster than things for scores. And games have really, like, you know, the breadth of styles has absolutely exploded in the last 10 to 15 years. And we're finally at a point now where I can speak to other people who love video games, and we have never played any of the same games at all. And we like completely different things. We're actually catching up with what I love about music and what I love about film and what I love about books, which is that there's no such thing as a uniform film fan, because some people absolutely adore, like, you know, Takeshi Kitano or whatever else, and other people absolutely adore, like, you know, your AAA kind of or blockbuster Hollywood films.
Yes, yeah.
And with games, I think we are getting to a point that, as you say, I think there is I think creators are starting to feel empowered because they're seeing people enjoy these meditative experiences. So an idea that they might have previously put to one side as there really isn't an audience for that, they've realized, well, actually, there's an audience for pretty much everything. And if you truly like the thing, you have to genuinely like the thing you're making. We're all very anxious the whole time creating stuff and thinking, is it good enough? But if in your heart you genuinely like what you're making, you can guarantee there is another human being out there that will like it as well. So
yeah, I feel like that's a great thing for indie developers in particular.
Yeah, yeah. I think but as I say, it's about being tuned into your own kind of critical awareness, because actually, with making games, there are huge technical hurdles and that kind of stuff. And so it can be quite a triumph just getting something working, but you have to kind of go beyond that and be more critical and say, well, it just working isn't good enough. Do I actually like it as an experience, you know?
Yes.
And if you can, as I say, if you can look at something you've made and say, I genuinely like this and I genuinely would play this if someone else delivered it to me, then yeah, then you're onto something, I think.
Thanks for listening to the first season of Inside Indie Games. And I've got just one ask for you just now. Find us on Twitter at UK Games Fund and tell us who you want to hear on a future episode. We'll do our best to track them down and bring them on. And if you want to find out more about us too, hop over to ukgamesfund.com. See you in the next episode.